The Tom Woods Show, episode 2298.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody. I'm giving away three free courses from my Liberty Classroom. One of them is ex-Marxist Michael Rechtenwald teaching you about critical theory so you can understand leftism and fight it better, as well as our course on how Alexander Hamilton screwed up America and the history of the conservative and libertarian movements. Check it out at 3freecourses.com. Hey, everybody. Tom Woods here. I am with the great Gene Epstein, who has so many credentials. I don't know if I should just go through them every time, but just take my word for it. The guy has a resume as long as my arm.
Yes.
And I would say I have like an average size arm here. And that is a lot of credentials. But not to mention, he is, of course, these days, as you probably know, the director of the Soho Forum, the great debate series, libertarian debate series in New York City. And Gene, you and I are going to be appearing at an event together coming up on, yes, I know, it's April Fool's Day, April 1st.
That's correct, Tom. And of course, as you know, I speak with hushed and respectful tones toward you, Tom, ever since you become a pretty major donor to my Soho Forum. But I'm going to try to just treat you like another sloppy-ass interviewer and be blunt with you, as usual, about everything you ask me about. But I do want to make the grander announcement. Since I'm a New York City impresario, Tom, I've got the big vision. And I want to point out to all of the outer towners, including people who maybe coming in from the outer boroughs of New York City, that you could have a grand long weekend in New York City if you make it to New York by the morning or the afternoon of Thursday, March 30th, because then there will be a major Soho Forum debate. Jason Riley, Manhattan Institute senior fellow Jason Riley, will be taking the affirmative, and NYU Professor Nikhil Singh, the negative, on the resolution, upward mobility for Black Americans lies in rejecting the policies of progressive government while making the most of the opportunities offered by American society. We do expect a sellout crowd for that. And we're trying to get NYU students to come to that one especially. So we're doing a special pitch on the NYU campus. Our venue at 18 Bleecker Street really is basically a three-block walk from the campus. But do come for that. And then maybe that evening, Friday evening, catch the revival of the play that goes wrong, the play that Tom Woods has seen 96 times or somewhere in that.
Somewhere in that neighborhood.
And Tom is apparently seeing, you said you're seeing the prequel when you're coming to town in April. It's actually a prequel to The Play Goes Wrong. Isn't that what you, because you're a real scholar in things going wrong, Tom.
No, that is true. That is true. And again, I remind people, especially people new to the podcast, that you know, you're inclined to say, I don't know where these people are going. I got to shut this off. No, this is the tradition. When Gene Epstein's a guest, we have our opening banter. You can always just fast forward to the 10-minute mark.
Yes,
and you're usually pretty safe.
Yeah, and some people prefer the banter and they shut off when I start.
They shut off the rest of it. That's right.
Look, we please everybody. But then the big thing is that on Saturday then, so this is your long weekend, on Saturday, starting in the 10 in the morning, 9 o'clock, I guess, is when it convenes on the Upper West Side, and that's on 84th and Broadway, which is not far from Tom's own stamping grounds because he was a student at Columbia University for many years. There is going to be the Take Human Action Tour, the kickoff, as Tom said. And not only me, I'm going to be the luncheon speaker. Our great friend Michael Heiss has said, I'm going to be talking over lunch. And I'm going to be talking about how, it's an interesting take, how I came to libertarianism through Austrian economics, that I became enamored of Austrian economics, and then that's how I got introduced to libertarianism. And of course, I'm going to explain the special role that Austrian economics has played in my life and should play in the lives of others. But then Tom is going to be an afternoon speaker along with Maj Touré and Dave Smith. You don't want to miss that. The next day, there's going to be a workshop. Maybe somewhere in there, you can catch some kind of, I don't know, matinee. There are shows Monday. Anyway, that's a fantastic weekend in New York City, which you don't want to miss. And that's my pitch.
Well, I'll have the details on the show notes page, but you can also find all the cities that the Take Human Action Tour is coming to, because I'll also be speaking at the Denver one, but there's a whole bunch of them. And you can find them at takehumanactiontour.com. takehumanactiontour.com. So you should say 84th and Broadway. I lived 30 blocks uptown from there when I was a student at Columbia. But even closer, I thought you were going to say close by is actually the apartment building where Murray Rothbard used to live, because that was 88th and Broadway, just four blocks away. There is an apartment building there. That's where Rothbard lived.
It's rent-stabilized haven. And Ludwig von Mises was not, he was on West End Avenue, a few blocks uptown. Yeah, Ludwig von Mises as well. So indeed, it's holy territory. It's where I raised my kids, by the way. I moved to the Upper West Side in the early 70s. My daughter was born there, and so was my son. And indeed, take the tour. There's so much to do. A long weekend. And of course, if you go to thesohoforum.org, you can get a listing of all our debates through the fall, through the autumn. All right, so that's my big announcement. And then I want to just throw another statement in. I was thinking, Tom, you might have asked me to talk about the bank bailouts and federal insurance. That's very much in the news. And I could a little bit, but probably you ought to get, and I want to mention in particular, David Stockman. I don't know if you're planning on that.
Oh, no, I have another person in mind I'm going to have tomorrow on that exact topic.
All right. Okay. All right.
I hadn't thought about David Stockman. I don't know why. That's a failing of my middle-aged brain.
Well, that's so funny, you know, because I got into trouble with Tom. Tom invited me on the show to trade thoughts with David about the future of the economy.
Yeah. And it was supposed to be like a friendly conversation. And Gene is like throwing barbs at him. You know, on December 12th, 2016, you said on Fox Business, blah, blah, blah. I can't believe you could say something. It was unbelievable. Like, David didn't know what happened. What was going on?
Tom and I are going to have a debate about this. As though, look, again, if you're going to make forecasts, I hold my feet to the fire about my forecasts, such as they were. I was holding David Stockman's feet to the
Read the room, Gene. It was not the time.
Oh, yes, indeed. Not the time. David Stockman is making forecasts on the Tom Woods Show, and Tom is wants to tell me it's not the time to remind David about his...
But you know what? Now that I think about it, Gene, I actually made him acknowledge a failed prediction, because he predicted that by some date, some year, maybe it was by the end of 2018, Trump would no longer be in office. They would have driven him out. And I said, then I'm going to take the gentleman's bet on that one. I'm going to bet that Trump stays in. And he had to admit, I mean, you have to admit that one. There's no denying that one.
That is another one of his failed for. No, I remember that one pretty vividly. Indeed, David does tend to be a stopped clock when it comes to forecasting the disasters of the U.S. economy that are imminent. But that aside, I do think he's got enormous strengths, and maybe having a great guy on about the bailout, maybe you should have two people.
Oh, he's a great analyst, no question about it.
Well, some of his numbers are very fuzzy. I can tell you I have some issues with this, the way he does some
of
his...
Are we relitigating the thing between you and Stockman?
All right. Yeah. David is great on bailouts.
The
chapter in David's book about the GM bailout, his fort is bailouts and the irony of bailouts and so on. So that's why I recommend him. So I wanted to show what a generous person, how nuanced I am. And now, because we transition into the nuanced presentation, I'm going to do on Adam Smith.
Okay, but back up. Let me introduce this part. All right. Because I want to talk about what happened. So on recent episode, I talked to Mark Skousen about Adam Smith because it was the 300th anniversary of the man's birth. And in the course of that, the debate that you had with Mark back in 2017 came up. Now, I had not seen that debate. So after I had the conversation with him, I put it on in the car. And so we're driving along. This was just, 2 days ago. We're driving in the car, listening to this debate. And Mark gives his opening statement. And the debate was about whether Adam Smith should be considered the father of free market economics, something like that.
The founder.
I beg your pardon, the founder.
Founder, father, same thing. Yeah.
So Mark, speaking in favor of the resolution, goes first. And I turned to my wife and said, that was a very convincing opening statement. So since I knew, Gene, that you had won the debate on the numbers, I said, okay, Gene must have some kind of barn burner of a response, because I thought that was a very effective opening statement. And did you ever? And in fact, by the time we get to the middle of the debate, where you two are asking each other questions and you're taking audience questions, it got so lively that I kept saying to her, this debate is so much fun. But do you know one other thing I said? No, first of all, let me say in parentheses that I feel the same way you do about Mark Skousen. I think he's a wonderful human being. He's a very kind person. He's shown me many kindnesses over the years. he and his wife divide their time between the coasts. Mm-hmm. We visited them on both coasts, but generally when they're in Florida, we get together for dinner from time to time, and it's always lively and fun, and he's always needling me about this or that difference we have, and it's just great. I really, really genuinely love the guy.
Yeah.
But I want to also add that listening to you be so lively in your responses, I said to Jenna, my regret with Gene is that I wasn't closer to him sooner.
Oh.
That's how I felt listening to that debate.
Well, thank you. You're going to make me cheer up. That's really that's the sweetest thing anybody said to me all day. And thank you for that, Tom. Absolutely.
Tell Hisako she's got to hop to it if Tom Woods is saying sweeter things than she is.
Well, she's a Japanese woman. She doesn't have a very high regard for gaijin. A gaijin is a non-Japanese guy.
Oh, well, she seems to be very nice to me. I'll put it that way. All right. She's very friendly with me.
Oh, come on. I said Tom is coming on April 1st, but we have to have him over.
I know. That is so kind. You guys are the best. Look, okay. We have to talk about Adam Smith. At this point, aside, it's ridiculous, Gene. We just set a record. We're at 13 minutes. We got to talk about Adam Smith.
Sorry. I'm sure you people skipped ahead. Okay.
So what your point was in the debate was not to say Adam Smith made no contributions or he was an idiot or anything like that, but that he is one of numerous people who collectively founded modern economics and free market economics. And that here's the key thing. We will fall into problems if we hold him up as the exclusive founder, because the errors he has, the non or anti-market things that he says, will and absolutely have been held up by people who dislike us and pointed to, well, look, even Adam Smith says blah, 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 blah. And I'll add in further parentheses, and then I'll turn it over to you. This is why, even though I very, very much appreciate the work of Milton Friedman and F.A. Hayek, I am sick and tired of being told even Milton Friedman thought, you know, he wasn't as extreme as you. Even F.A. Hayek thought the government had to do well.
Yes,
I am so tired of being told even this, even that by people who are supposed to be my heroes. I want to have heroes who make my enemies cower. They can't find one thing in them to use against me.
Actually, that is, you did cause me to puzzle over that even business, anticipating for a moment. I wanted to update my coverage of all the gotcha gang about Adam Smith that's come out of the woodwork now that we're in the 300th anniversary. And it's this book called Adam Smith's America, How a Scottish Philosopher Became an Icon of American Capitalism. A Harvard lecturer named Glory Liu, and she quotes Barack Obama. I hadn't even come across that one. Even Adam Smith said Barack Obama was quoting Adam Smith. So they're constantly using Adam Smith against us. I want to back and fill a little bit and give us a little intellectual history first. But just as a nice footnote, that debate that you enjoyed between me and Mark of a few years ago, it was moderated by Naomi Brockwell, who not long thereafter became my stepdaughter-in-law. And of course, you've had Naomi on the show a couple of times, Tom. Mm-hmm. And she had to moderate it rather lightly, but she did make some nice remarks and some nice jokes in between. So I do recommend it, and hopefully you'll put that on the show notes page, both the YouTube versions of that debate as well as the audio. And you did needle Mark. You were there. You knew that Mark had lost the debate. And I do have to put a fine point on something, that we do Oxford-style voting at our debates, and Mark broke the records for losing. He started with 44.2% of the vote and ended with 29.9%. Usually, if you lose a debate, you don't lose votes in your favor. It's just the other person goes way ahead of you. Mark lost ground considerably. I started with 15.6% of the vote, and I ended with 61%. And so it was just an off-the-charts loss on Mark's part.
Now, by the way, when we brought up the debate in the episode, I didn't mention that he lost the debate. He brought that up.
Well, because Mark is a clever guy and might have anticipated that you might have said, you might have brought that up yourself. But indeed, okay, yeah.
Or also, he was trying to forestall the email from Gene Epstein saying, hey, Mark, I noticed you didn't mention the outcome of our debate when you were on the Tom Woods show.
Right, right. Anyway, let me indulge in a little intellectual history and say the following and insert myself again a little bit. I first read Smith in a seminar with Robert Heilbronner, author of The Worldly Philosophers. And, you know, my crazy career had a lot to do with the fact that I became a writing assistant. I ghostwrote some of Robert Heilbronner, and he was making millions of bucks with his books. in particular, the worldly philosophers about. I never contributed to that book, to his textbook. And so that really helped my career. I didn't need a degree because I had the imprimatur of Robert Heilbronner, whom everybody had read. Robert Heilbronner absolutely loved Adam Smith. And that's where I first experienced a seminar, far and away his favorite economist. And I found him when I read the book, and I was in my 20s, before I encountered Murray Rothbard, before I had my Austrian awakening. I found the book to be exactly the way Murray Rothbard described it, and in a way very similar to Heilbronner's own writings. Heilbronner had a beautifully elegant writing style, as does Adam Smith. And that's, by the way, one of the reasons why I still put him on my Mount Rushmore, because he put things, when he was right, nobody put it better than the guy from Glasgow, Adam Smith. But then you read Rothbard, and Rothbard puts it in one sentence: the much-revered Wealth of Nations is a huge, sprawling, inchoate, confused tome, rife with vagueness, ambiguity, and deep inner contradictions. And that's what Rothbard wrote in his own two-volume History of Economic Thought. And indeed, this was plain to me right from the start. I had to do a presentation. The book was just, it had great passages and had ridiculous passages. And so I already had this feeling about Adam Smith being off the wall, slightly crazy, albeit great where the passages were on point and on target. But then I was surprised. Murray Rothbard's two-volume book on economic thought didn't come out until 1995. And that was basically the year he died. And of course, he didn't complete the final volume, didn't live to complete it. But this is kind of funny. As part of intellectual history, that book would not have been published. Murray's statement about the problems with Adam Smith, Murray Rothbard's statement, had Mark Skousen not commissioned the work in the first place. He told me he got Murray Rothbard a $50,000 advance for that book. Huge money. And Mark sort of wryly said that may be part of the reason why Rothbard spent so much time on that book. But then here's what I think is funny. Because then Mark writes a book that contradicts Rothbard. But here's what's funny. I'm reading Rothbard's acknowledgments of Mark Skousen in the History of Economic Thought. And he writes, Mark envisioned the work as a standard Smith to the present, moderately sized book, a sort of contra Heilbronner. After pondering the problem, however, I told him that I would have to begin with Aristotle, since Smith was a sharp decline from many of his predecessors. Neither of us realized then the scope and length of the ensuing research. And indeed, Rothbard didn't live to do the next volume. It sort of makes you chuckle, because I know Rothbard was driving Mark crazy. He's got to go back to Aristotle. And by the way, I think that's a delightful book. I know what you think of Rothbard's History of Economic Thought, but I find I could just dip into it.
I love it too. I will say, though, that even as somebody who's written on similar topics, I would say the chapters in Volume 1 on the subject of interest and usury really bogged down. I really don't need to know all the nuances between this thinker and that thinker on that subject. I mean, but if I do need to know it, I know where to look. It's just not doesn't make good reading.
Too much, really? Okay. I mean, I'm trying to remember.
I defy anyone to contradict me on that. I mean, really? What is it, 150 pages? It's some enormous amount of time spent on
really?
That. Yeah.
Really? He talks about Aristotle, Plato. I just thought it was sort of delightful that just right from the start, our great thinkers were pondering the issues of economics and often getting it wrong. I found it rather entertaining. I don't quite remember your point about the usury. It's been a while since I read it.
Oh, geez, go back. I'm going to tell you, when we finish this, go pick it up off your shelf. You're going to say, oh my gosh, how did I ever get through these chapters? And I say this as somebody who, I mean, if Rothbard were alive today, I would take a bullet for that guy. I mean, I yield to no one in my admiration for that.
Well, I know. And look, again, I'm like you, Tom, in one sense. It's just that Rothbard's achievements, his writings, is so overwhelming. It's just that I don't require people to be as enthusiastic about Rothbard as Tom and I are. But how can you ever deny that there's a lot of great stuff from this? How can you be contemptuous of this guy? Anyway, that aside, we're digressing again. But getting back to my narrative, the crazy part of it is then Mark then writes a book praising Adam Smith to the skies after Rothbard eviscerates Smith. And I think, by the way, overdoes it a bit in eviscerating Smith. I know Rothbard would certainly not include Smith on his Mount Rushmore. I mean, the Mount Rushmore point is kind of an arbitrary point anyway. But I would concede to the enthusiasts of Smith that there are passages there that are just so terrific. And he did have an influence on freer trade. So influence matters to some degree. And so I'm readily conceding that he's one of the founders, one of the fathers. But here's something I want to point out about Mark. This is not a never story. Up till now, I've not told this story on him. I wrote Mark a while back, and I have the email in my email in my Gmail account. I wrote Mark just for starters, and now to capitulate my main argument against Mark at the debate. I said that Mark is asking us to engage in two kinds of cover-ups. The one which you've mentioned, Tom, is covering up all the awful stuff in Smith, all the left-wing progressive babble in Smith that keeps coming up, and that's extensive, and that the Gotcha Gang is constantly citing. The left-wing Gotcha Gang. But then the other part of it is that most of the criticisms of Smith that we can make are not anachronistic. As Rothbard points out, there was already great stuff coming out of the Spanish, out of the French. Smith clearly read Richard Cantillon, the Irishman, the Parisian by way of Ireland, who wrote in French. And that book was called by both Jevons, rather Cantillon's book, Essay on the Nature of Trade, was called by Hayek and Jevons to be the first great work on economics. So therefore, we're covering up all the achievements prior to Smith, and Mark is forgiving Smith for his mistakes when Smith had no right to make those mistakes if he had read Cantillon.
But can we talk specifically about what some of the mistakes were? I mean, you spent talking about usury laws.
Okay, I'm going to make
that. What else can we talk about? Obviously, directly bearing on Cantillon,
yes,
we would talk about his failure to reckon with entrepreneurship.
Precisely, okay. Great. Thanks, Tom, because now I can continue with my narrative.
And by the way, parentheses. Yeah. And again, Mark, if you're listening, I have nothing but respect for you. But in the debate, Mark was very upset that you were talking about Cantillon's book because he says Cantillon's book is so short. He says Institute had to pad it to make it look like a real book. It's a really short book. But The Law by Bastiat's a short book, but it's potentially a revolutionary book. You know, if he says what he needs to say and he gets in and he gets out, that's okay.
Yes, Tom, that's well put. And since you mentioned that, when I listened to your interview with Mark, I had to groan that Mark is playing the Marilyn Monroe card again. The Marilyn Monroe card, which is male chauvinist and crude. I know that Marilyn Monroe may not have been that beautiful if you look close. I mean, it's just silly points. If you recall, I just joked around and they said, well, Marilyn Monroe is beautiful and so is Elizabeth Taylor. His arguments are just so silly.
Well, let me explain what his point was that Marilyn Monroe, everyone concedes, is a beautiful woman. But if you were to get super, super close up to her, all you would see is imperfections. And so he says, that's what you're doing with Adam Smith, whereas everyone but Gene, apparently, thinks Marilyn Monroe is a beautiful woman. And everyone but Gene thinks Adam Smith is a system builder whom we should all revere.
Okay, that was a good
point. That's what he was saying.
Okay, I got to pick up on two strands, Tom. Number one, as you know, everyone but Gene.
I know that's not true. I'm just reporting what was said.
Okay, George Reisman, by the way, who also focused very clearly in his book, Capitalism, very great Austrian economist, George Reisman. You've had him on your show at least once or twice.
A couple times, yeah.
And then everybody but Joseph Schumpeter. Yeah. Who also, as you know, eviscerated Smith, mostly was very, very surprisingly critical of Smith in his own history of economic thought. So I'm hardly alone, as you know. But I want to tell this story. And since you mentioned entrepreneurship, you're impatient that I get to the flaws. I wrote Mark, this is true. I wrote Mark, Cantillon originated the concept of entrepreneurship, and Smith read the book. He mentions Cantillon at one point in The Wealth of Nations, Smith does, and yet Smith never picked up on that point about entrepreneurship, or barely did. The bare mentions of being undertaker are, as Schumpeter said, it's too skimpy to be credited. He was tone deaf to that, to entrepreneurship. Mark literally wrote me, get this, Mark literally wrote me, you're making a big mistake, Gene. The term entrepreneurship was not used until John Baptist Say came along decades later. And the only reason why you find the word entrepreneurship in the translations of Cantillon is because the translators used that word from Say from decades later. And I said to Mark, you're wrong. Here's the French language version of Cantillon's book. You'll see the term is used 100 times. You'll also see, if you just look it up, Cantillon didn't even seem to originate it. I don't know. It was used in 1723 in France. So Mark admitted he was wrong. What did that tell me? What that told me is that Mark had supposedly read Rothbard on Cantillon, because he midwifed that book. It was clear that Mark had simply not really familiarized himself with Cantillon. And now, by the way, I have the somewhat dubious honor of being acknowledged in the latest edition of Mark's book for having made a contribution to his understanding, because he didn't even know that the term entrepreneurship had been current in French and was used by Cantillon all the time in the French version. So again, I'm only trying to point out just a little bit of intellectual history that nobody's ever heard before. Okay. Now, again, as you said, the entrepreneurship point, but I want to go back to the usury. You want to say something about entrepreneurship? Because I want to go back to usury.
No, I want to say is, if you're going to be friends with Gene Epstein, there are ups and downs, okay? He may go on the Tom Woods show and point out your intellectual peccadilloes.
Okay, this is always peccadillo. Mark is tear-assing around the world, lecturing on Adam Smith, leading with his chin. I bridle at all these, I'm going to quote in a moment, all these contemptuous statements about we free market fanatics, that we love Adam Smith and that we can't even read him properly, you know, and we are constantly being belittled by others, we free market people, because we're supposedly in love with Adam Smith. And yet these writers, and of course these writers are going to start citing Mark Skousen as a primary example of us foolish types. And what I bridle about is that these people don't bother to read Rothbard, Schumpeter, or Riesman, and they don't have to listen to my debate. I'm a minor figure in this fight. But anyway, so it's more than just a peccadillo. It's really a big problem that persists. But I want to mention the usury point because it really is of some importance. And in my debate with Mark, I pointed out that Nobel laureate economist Amartya Sen had written an essay in the New York Review of Books in which he set us up as usual about Adam Smith, the great economist and all the rest, great advocate of the free market, but that Smith wanted credit controls. Now, credit controls, of course, being the same as the usury laws. He wanted a cap on the interest rate. And Mark told me that, oh, Smith was only making that point for moral reasons. He just didn't like people to charge high rates of interest. It was just a moral point. But this is just three sentences, which I want to read from Smith, which I read to Mark during the debate. Smith goes on for several pages about the need to cap the interest rate at 5%. And he writes, if the legal rate of interest in Great Britain, for example, was fixed so high as 8 or 10%, the greater part of the money which was to be lent would be lent to prodigals and projectors who alone would be willing to give this high rate of interest. Sober people would not venture into the competition. A great part of the capital of the country would thus be kept out of the hands of those most likely to make a profitable and advantageous use of it, and thrown into those which were most likely to waste and destroy it. He was dealing then with a consequential, this is Smith, the consequences of allowing a 10% rate of interest is that those who are sober, who borrow at lower rates of interest, are going to be shut out. Now, I quoted Cantillon in that debate. Cantillon writing decades before Smith. Cantillon on the usury laws. Quote, nothing is more entertaining than the multitude of laws and rules made in every country on the subject of the interest of money, always unnecessarily by sages who barely understand the facts of commerce. Cantillon goes on to say, interest is always highest in proportion to the greater risk. All right. So what have I tried to establish there, Tom? Cantillon was writing sensible things about the rate of interest. We're now living through a couple of days recently where the flight into quality, people are buying up treasuries, as you may have read. The treasury rate is going up because people are fleeing into safe bonds. So obviously, the naivete of Smith in that regard is just colossal, not understanding that there's always a trade-off between safety and the level of risk and the level of the interest rate. There's a reason why high-yield bonds are called junk bonds. But of course, I can't hold Adam Smith responsible for that. The junk bond term came many years thereafter. But all he had to do was read Cantillon, and he would have been straightened out about this gaffe. And then you'd wonder, how naive can this person be about markets if he literally thinks that if you allow a 10% rate of interest, Tom Woods Enterprise is a safe, successful business, which has paid off its debtors for many years and is asking for a 5% rate of interest, can't compete with those fly-by-nighters at 10% who default all the time. That's how the market quotes the interest rate. So I just wanted to quote that to say that the errors in Smith can be appalling just on their face, but then we can say, oh, with the benefit of hindsight, did nobody understand the trade-off between risk and reward in the bond market? Well, Contion did. And so that's my main point about the usury laws. And I hope you regard that as a pretty devastating point about the obtuseness of Adam Smith on a key issue. Amartya Sen pounces and says, hey, Adam Smith loved the usury laws, and you fools who love Adam Smith must recognize that. So that's what makes me annoyed,
yes,
to say the least.
I hear that.
Yeah.
We'll help people by keeping them from getting capital that they need, or we'll help people. I always feel like if somebody chooses to do something, that's probably that person's first best option.
Well,
and
yes.
So I'm not helping that person by taking away his first best option.
Yes.
And if his first best option is borrowing at 8%, okay, well, that's what his best option is. I mean, if the people who want to take this option away from him, they're not going to lend him anything. They're not going to help him out. You know, like it reminds me of people, for some reason, it reminds me of people who say, you know, they'll see, like, let's say some Catholic cathedral or something, and they'll say that money should have been given to the poor because, you know, they're morally superior to people who build cathedrals.
Yeah, yeah.
And then my thought is, okay, I have a funny feeling that after making that statement, you yourself are going to go on not helping the poor yourself as you've done through your life. You're going to continue not doing. Before I go on, let me say a quick thing that will help a lot of you, and you know who you are. If you are in business and you're getting buried by your competition online, then build your brand, your reputation, and your lead flow with digital marketing by Persist SEO, our great sponsor. If you're a small local business, you're trying to compete against large companies in the service industry, increase your visibility with Persist SEO. Or if you have low or no leads coming in on a consistent basis, well, website search engine and conversion optimization can help move the needle to a more prosperous business model for you. If you're tired of cold calling, use your website as a lead generation engine. If you're not showing up for your services on the search engines, then get found with Persist SEO's expert search engine optimization. All you have to do is call 770-580-3736 or visit them at ineedseo.help for a free website audit and consultation. That's 770-580-3736 or ineedseo.help. What about the stuff, though, about if somebody in a pin factory all day long doing the same repetitive task to make his living?
That's a goodie, and you've been pushing me to go on to goodies. I just wanted to make the point that we have had pawn shops and we do have payday lending. And there too, people like Elizabeth Warren could quote Adam Smith that payday lending interest rates are sky high. Pawn shops, actually, which have been around for decades for poor people, the interest rates are sky high. And it was Thomas Sowell, among others, and you just made the point that this is just an option for people.
And right. And by the way, also these rent-to-own furniture stores.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
People will say, well, if I added up all the rental payments, turns out this living room set costs way more than if somebody just bought it. Yeah, but these people can't just buy it because they have no credit. And secondly, I actually have been contacted by people who run rent-to-own stores, and they say, you have no idea the kind of people we deal with.
Yeah.
The people we have to chase down who are deadbeats, who keep the furniture, they don't make the payments, or they ruin the furniture. You have no idea the people we're dealing with.
I had a good moment, Tom. My moment at the magazine I used to write for, a couple of journalists were allowed to say we should shut down payday lending. And I said, well, the main result is that the interest rate will go down because the loan sharks charge less because they break your legs if you don't pay. You know, that's why they can charge less, you know. Yeah, indeed. So, all right, we've exhausted the usury laws thing. Okay, all right, I have a whole thing on that, Tom, which I want to quote. Now, in the book, Adam Smith's America, How a Scottish Philosopher Became an Icon of American Capitalism, a contemptuous book about how Adam Smith has been treated in America, which I'm going to get to your point about the pin factory and the division of labor. But that's the most recent example of the gotcha gang. It got some reviews as well.
And again, let's just clarify that everybody doesn't understand what you mean. Gotcha gang is people on the left. Now, yes. Boy, Gene really won't like that we're using that term. But you and I understand what the term means. So the people on the left, interventionists, point to Adam Smith and say, look, Smith said such and such, and you stupid free market people didn't understand Smith, and even he doesn't believe in your fundamentalism. That's what we're talking about when we say gotcha gang.
Thank you, Tom. And indeed, yeah, that's the gotcha gang that I'm talking about. But then, in fact, by the way, you inspired me just to digress from him. Do you know that if you listen to the debate carefully, Bob Bowden, who pointed this out, he said he was laughing in the audience. In this beginning remarks rebutting me, Mark said, Gene just reminds me of those left-wing Marxist progressives.
He himself used the terms that he hates?
He came up with every insult. And then next thing you know, he sanitized. He doesn't use those, but he just used those to describe me. I've needled Mark about this. So I've given him all the pain. You don't have to give him any further pain about that. Again, just a little bit of hypocrisy there. But again, it's a minor failing in Mark. He's got a stellar personality in most other ways. Anyway, but that aside, we're talking about the division of labor. And indeed, see, this is the funny part.
Well, did you want to say anything further about that new book, or was that?
Thank you, Tom. The only thing I wanted to say about it is that the author says a couple times, well, I can cover everybody who's commented on Smith in America, but then the number of citations just goes on and on and on. So many people she's citing, but somehow, can we forgive her for missing Rothbard? Well, he's supposed to be a marginal figure, or Reisman, perhaps, but you know, if it's in America, you know, Schumpeter was a professor at Harvard, and she's supposed to be a scholar, and she's at Harvard, and she misses out. She has there's a very glancing mention of Schumpeter that isn't pursued. So again, it's a skewed book. I think she might have intentionally left out Schumpeter because he's presumably pretty major, and he did have an effect on the profession. He was at Harvard. So that's one of my problems with this book, that she really isn't covering Adam Smith's America adequately, even though she might plead, hey, look, I can't discuss everyone. That's too much of a request. Well, she does discuss free market people, so maybe she should mention Rothbard. So that's one of the problems. But the other part of it is that this book, as well as the reviews that were written, now get into something that I think is kind of interesting, which is something that hasn't been, to my mind, stressed enough about what Murray Rothbard teaches us in his book about the great economist. He teaches us not to be so reverential, and certainly not even, don't be so reverential about me, Rothbard is basically saying. If a book is huge, sprawling, and confused, then what happens? Then the lunatic academicians regard that as a virtue. It gives them, as Rothbard goes on to write in his own discussion, this gives the scholars so much to do. They can now put together this and that. It never occurs to them that maybe it's simply a huge, sprawling, confused tome, that maybe the guy is inconsistent. Maybe the guy is confused. But after all, if this is Adam Smith, how can he possibly be confused? Why do I mention that? Because, by the way, I reread Smith and I reread what Murray says about this, just to be clear. Murray points out that Smith's celebration of the division of labor in book one, and then his evisceration of the division of labor in book five, this is Adam Smith's book, that they can't be reconciled. Well, to put it another way, if you're going to talk about how the division of labor brings civilization, it actually sharpens skills, it does all these wonderful things, and then hundreds of pages later, it turns everybody into stupid dolts, then an editor would say, Adam, would you put those two thoughts together in one? Because you sort of, it's like it's two different people have written those parts of your long book. If you think that the division of labor has both good and bad elements about it, that there are ironies in it, then put that together. But my point then is that when the author of the Adam Smith America discusses this and the reviewers discuss this, they discuss it as though the brilliant Adam Smith was totally aware of this contradiction, that what Adam Smith is brilliantly leaving for us is something for us to all wrestle with, as though it isn't a fault in the book, it's a virtue. But that's the reason why you sort of throw up your hand. You're talking about Adam Smith as though he's some sort of God who's immune to the normal current of criticism about how well you write and how well you introduce an idea. Rothbard brings us back down to earth in his book, and he points out Aristotle could go off the rails, Plato can go, all these great thinkers, brilliant guys, but they can frequently go way off the rails. They had good insights and bad. And that, I think, in a way, is the major lesson in all this, that Adam Smith had some good insights and bad, but he was clearly a very confused guy. By the way, the real Adam Smith problem is indeed why he was so ambivalent about capitalism. I guess I want to go back to the division of labor time, but I want to make sure we have enough time to point out what most bothered George Riesman about Smith's book, which is that Smith literally talks about how profits are a deduction against the wages of labor. He tells a legend about how first enterprise was just run by the workers, and then the capitalists came along, and they started to take their cut. They started to take something off the top. That, by the way, shows the completely tone-deaf understanding of entrepreneurship and of the role of the capitalists. Because, by the way, he also thought the landowners were parasites, that landowners do no good. But there, because we can forgive him a little bit, because so many landowners were really just inheriting land from kings. There's a lot of corruption in the inheritance of land, and that got Smith carried away. But when Smith talks about how capitalists are basically exploiting workers, there might indeed be a certain connection there. Riesman says, in that sense, Smith is really the pre-Marxist. Capitalists are exploiters. I know this shocks people when Riesman says this, but the argument might be that Smith inspired Ricardo. Ricardo was inspired by Smith, and Ricardo, in turn, inspired Karl Marx with the exploitation theory. But anyway, I wanted to mention that. But perhaps we can go back to the alienation point. This Rothbard says, Smith sowed the seeds of the alienation idea about the division of labor, that if you're just working in the pin factory and you're doing one part of the job for your whole life, it's going to turn you into a stupid person. You have any special comment on that? Because I do. I would take some of that seriously a little bit, but what would be your comment on that, Tom?
On what specific?
Well, on the idea that, I mean, the point is what I'm trying to say is that for Smith to say the division of labor is civilizing, it sharpens skills, people become good at what they do, wonderful things come from a totally uncritical, over-the-top celebration of the division of labor in book one. And then in book five, it turns everybody stupid. It's alien. Then people are not good enough to serve in the army.
Yeah, maybe he's thinking, if I try to be as charitable as possible, maybe first he's thinking society-wide. We all know that we advance socially and culturally if people specialize.
Yeah.
And as the market develops, they can specialize in more things and cater to more niches and satisfy more preferences that people have. But for the individuals involved in some of these lines of work, it can nevertheless be a tough slog. So let's try to be as friendly to Smith as we can. Can we not admit that a job on an assembly line where you're doing the same task over and over and over all day long, where I'm sure those tasks are probably being automated more and more these days. But as a human being had to do the same thing over and over and over, is Smith really wrong to say that at the end of the day, the person becomes mentally numbed by this?
Okay. Again, I just want to emphasize, if I may, my earlier point, which is that I would have told Smith if I was editing the book, Adam, put all those insights in the same part of your book. Because, by the way, he does use the word civilized initially in this description of the division of labor. He does talk about how it sharpens skills. Now, obviously, we do know that if you do podcasting, it sharpens your skills. So therefore, there's a certain elements of the division of labor that heighten your brain and so on. But then there's another part of it. I'm going to grant you a point. I just want to emphasize that these people, the author of Adam Smith's America, they give Adam Smith a pass on this. And they say, oh, this brilliant guy, he's giving us this dilemma. Put it all in the same book. Same section. Rothbard was right to say it's a complete mess. He contradicts himself. But okay, I want to comment now on the point you raised, Tom. Absolutely, that is conceivable. But to brand the division of labor across the board as resulting in that is a little bit ridiculous. Certainly, if you're talking about the modern day economy or even the economy of 50 years ago, I guess I have to take a pass on the economy of Adam Smith at that time. There were people who had specialties, and Smith mentions it, blacksmiths and so on, that sharpened their skills. So it does cut both ways a little bit, because if you have something that's somewhat challenging to do in your role in the division of labor, then it can give you more confidence as a person, your role in the world, rather than being the idea who's got to be the jack of all trades and master of none. So it does cut both ways. However, certainly, if anybody saw the movie City Lights with Charlie Chaplin, he's working on the assembly line and he does the same thing all the time, and that deadens him. But certainly to talk about that today, in the year 2023, in this book about Unsourced America and the rest of it, the treatment they give it is a little silly, because just as you said, Tom, the repetitive tasks of the sort that we talk about in a pin factory are pretty much taken over mechanization or perish the thought robots. So I think that it's kind of irrelevant. For the most part, people, they not only play different roles in the production process, very few people stick with the same job. So to conjure up an image of somebody just doing that all his life is a little silly, apart from the obvious point that the real repetitive jobs are automated. And then I would introduce another aspect of this. There's great concern about low IQ people. You know, I make the point when I hear about it, and I'd like to know more about it. I've been talking to them. Well, how are low IQ people going to have a role in this economy? And I make the point that I read all the time about people with Down syndrome who are employed, that there are thousands and thousands of people with IQs of like less than 70 who have jobs in this economy today. And I wonder, we probably should want to know something about that. Why do I mention that? Because I have made at least a talking point to people when they say, oh, capitalism is leaving the low IQ people way behind. We need government intervention. We need subsidies. And then I do try to make the point that, you know, what a capitalist likes to do, if you run a restaurant, the classic things were, you have a brilliant chef, but the brilliant chef knows that in order to employ commodity labor, you want to simplify all the tasks. And so you want to simplify it for people. What I'm trying to get at is that the other silver lining to the idea of repetitive, relatively simple tasks is that it helps give employment to almost anybody of whatever intelligence. Some people do have Down syndrome, but maybe I haven't said enough about that. You're thinking.
No, but that's a good point, because it reminds me, frankly, of the Walmart greeter.
Yeah.
Now, I know we can have all kinds of criticisms of Walmart and they get this and that special privilege, and I hear all that.
Oh, yes. Oh, sure.
But the Walmart greeter is an example of somebody who doesn't have to be particularly intelligent, but who apparently plays some kind of role. Although I have to say, I haven't seen a Walmart greeter in a while, so maybe this is out of date. I don't know. Or maybe I just phased them out of my brain. I don't notice them anymore.
Yes.
But not to mention, it does mean that a lot of the work at a Walmart would require advanced knowledge. Like, for example, managing inventory. That would have been, on an enterprise of this scale, would have been a nightmare.
Yeah.
But I am quite certain it's all simplified and mechanized and computerized so that even a dope can do it on some level. And that is an advance for everybody, because as you say, it means that not everybody has to be a genius to get employed.
I did see one video, I'm trying to remember, of a guy with Down syndrome who worked in a supermarket. He was proud of the fact that he had a job, that he was gainfully employed, that he had a role to play in this economy. And clearly they weren't giving him challenging work to do. And what I'm saying is that, to put a finer point on, there is, as I said, oddly, the Marxist critique of what the capitalist likes to do has some validity in that, again, the restaurant or any workplace, if you want to employ cheap labor, think about how you can simplify the task, spread them out among a number of different people so you don't have to pay a whole lot of money for intelligent, skilled labor to do those tasks. So there is motivation on the part of capitalists, it is true, to try to think of the labor process as relatively simple. I don't know enough. I know when I was asked, well, where do the Down syndrome people work? I said, I gather they have a lot of work in supermarkets and in retail stores to do simple tasks that they can do. So this gives them dignity. And of course, for the author of that book about Unsourced America, I would say to her, most people do have something challenging to do. Another anecdote, by the way, in Charles Murray and Hersey's book on the bell curve on intelligence, he had sort of a funny passage where he said that you'd think it doesn't take intelligence to be a busboy, to just bus the tables. He said, but really, Raven gets into it. To do a really efficient job busing the tables requires a mathematical mind, you know, that actually can be challenging to do a good job of it. So that we tend to think that there aren't, but then of course, then Murray can't win. Then they say, well, what are all the 70 IQ people going to do in this economy? Well, at the end of the day, I think the problem is a little bit exaggerated by Adams, even in this day. And of course, the anti-capitalist gotcha gang, you just defined it, they want to make a big deal out of it. And it doesn't look as though it's nearly as big a deal as they indicate. But it's certainly worth commenting on, for sure. However, I don't think we can let Adam Smith off the hook about it. I would have told him, Adam, write a little bit more thoughtfully about this. On the one hand, it's bringing civilization, it sharpens people. On the other hand, it's alienating. Discuss it all in one place, and you can enlighten us a little bit more about what's on your mind. And then I would say, why don't you rethink that business about how the capitalist exploits all the workers, that the enterprise is run by the workers, and the capitalist takes something off the top, and the workers get less as a result? Aren't you pro-capitalist? I mean, there's so much mess in Adam Smith. Although, let me come down on Murray a little bit, because this is funny. Murray Rothbard, in his two-volume work, he writes some very engaging biographical details about Adam Smith, and he seems to be correct in saying that Adam Smith was actually very zealous in running the tariff. He worked for the government, and they charged tax. He was in charge of the tariff board. Maybe I'm misusing the term. Toward the end of his life, Smith earned good money enforcing tariffs. And Murray even says that Smith actually enforced the rules and bragged about enforcing the rules pretty severely. And Murray says, you can't let him off the hook that he decided to do this because he wanted to make the rules lax. And Murray may well be right about that. I have no reason to doubt it. So here, Adam Smith, most famous for writing some wonderful passages, by the way, about free trade, was actually in practice a hypocrite. He was in charge of tariffs and enforced them and bragged about how much money he was making for the government doing this. So that's fine. But the only part of it that makes me smile is that it did appear that it was like Murray's gotcha. I mean, that doesn't diminish, you know, he might have been a hypocrite, but still, the book is great on free trade. So therefore, I was going to tell him, aren't you considered confusing his personal behavior and professional behavior from his writing? Because his writing on free trade, isn't that pretty impeccable? I can't recall anything Smith wrote about free trade that wasn't really terrific in The Wealth of Nations. So that's coming down on Murray a little bit, where his dislike of Smith and Smith's personality is so great, he gets a little carried away.
Well, fair enough. I guess I'm probably on the show notes page. I'm going to link, obviously, to So Forum, as I always do, takehumanactiontour.com. Yeah. But also, I want to link to your debate with Mark this subject, which
the podcast and the video. Yeah.
I assure you, folks, I listened to it rather than watched. I was driving. I am a responsible person.
Yeah.
But I assure you it's worth your time and that you'll find it highly entertaining.
Yeah.
But I'll also link to the Classical Economics, this volume 2 of the Rothbard History of Thought. If you want to read Rothbard's pretty unrelenting criticisms of Smith for yourself, you can certainly go ahead and do that. So
yes,
that'll all be up at tomwoods.com/2298. Is there anything I'm overlooking, Jim?
Well, next episode will be probably in 2076, the 300th anniversary of the publication of The Wealth of Nations. We've said a lot about Smith. In fact, you had me on once before about it, this about 4 years ago. So we've done a fair amount about it. But I guess that's pretty much it. I hope we all recognize that we can stop the madness. We can like Smith. We don't have to idolize him.
I think that is a fair and balanced judgment. Yeah. Gene Epstein, thanks so much for your time today.
Pleasure, Tom. See you in New York on April 1st. Bye-bye.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.